This morning, Brother Joe Miguez will speak to us, and his topic is Regretfully Yours. Regretfully Yours. Brother Joe.
Brother Greg. On a personal note, before we begin our discourse this morning, after today, Sister Kathy and I will be apart from your midst for a little while. And so we wanted to let you know and say goodbye to you and that we'll be missing you. We'll be on a long trip out west with our family, seeing some of the sights of the country and visiting with the brethren. We'll be serving some of the ecclesias along our way. And we won't be back here for Sunday meetings until August 12th. And then after that one Sunday when we're back, we'll be leaving again on another trip overseas with a group of brethren, just Sister Kathy and myself, to Israel and Egypt, and we won't return from that trip and be back with you until September 9th. So it'll be quite some time before we see each other once again on a regular basis, but we will be thinking of you. Our subject is Regretfully Yours. When we write personal letters to each other, we usually end them with a closing salutation, such as, your sister in Christ, or yours in the one hope, and then we sign our name. In more formal business letters, there is usually also a closing salutation such as yours truly or sincerely yours. Many of the books of the Bible are letters. Letters to individuals, letters to groups, open letters to whomever would read them. In the New Testament, a common closing salutation used by Paul in letters is, Grace be with you. In the Old Testament, there is a book that is in the form of an open letter, a written discourse to whomever would read it or hear it read. It has a very specific conclusion, a very pointed summary, but it has no closing salutation. If it did have a closing salutation in the style of a modern-day business letter, I think this book would be signed, Regretfully Yours. The book is, our opening hymn gave you a clue, the book of Ecclesiastes. If I were to ask you to quote a few scriptures from the book of Ecclesiastes, which ones would come to your mind? Probably chapter 12, verse 1, Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Or perhaps a text which forms the foundation of much of our doctrine about the nature of death, Ecclesiastes 9:10. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave, whither thou goest. Another important text which helps us understand symbolic scriptures in comparison to literal statements of scriptures is also found in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 4. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. Other than these three verses, we probably don't keep much of the book of Ecclesiastes in our minds, although there are quite a few popular sayings found in the book, such as, a fly in the ointment, or there is nothing new under the sun, or cast thy bread upon the waters, and of course the well-known vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This morning we're going to consider some lessons from the book of Ecclesiastes, although we won't cover the entire book in detail. Before we begin considering the book itself, however, there are two controversies about the book that I'd like to briefly mention. One of those controversies is, who wrote the book? Most Bible scholars agree that it was Solomon, particularly in view of the opening words of the book in chapter 1, verse 1, Ecclesiastes 1:1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. A minority of commentators contend that when you look at Ecclesiastes in the original Hebrew, from which it's translated into our English, there are words and expressions that were not known until several hundred years after Solomon's death. And so they present the thought that, therefore, it must have been written by someone later than Solomon. Those who believe Solomon is the true author counter that challenge or that argument with the concession that a later compiler may have put Solomon's thoughts together along with a few words and expressions of his own from his own day, and that would explain how those expressions in the Hebrew unknown in Solomon's day could have entered into the book. But again, the content of the book is still exclusively Solomon's thoughts. It seems to me that this is the only reasonable conclusion, that in fact Solomon is the author of the book. The second controversy about the book of Ecclesiastes concerns what appears to be self-contradictions or even statements of false doctrine that appear in a few places in the book. As an example, let's turn briefly to Ecclesiastes 7, 16 and 17. Ecclesiastes 7, 16 and 17. This is perhaps not the best example, but there are a few others. Be not righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? Be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? And on a few occasions, you'll see thoughts that apparently contradict each other like this presented in the book. Two similar thoughts that explain these contradictions are, first, that the book of Ecclesiastes is actually a dialogue between a teacher and an infidel, or a seeker after truth who is doubting and counters the teacher's words. Or secondly, and this is a similar explanation, that the book is a collection entirely of Solomon's thoughts, but that Solomon's thoughts in the book reflect both wisdom and folly. As Solomon himself said, he set out to know in verse 17 of chapter 1. And let's turn back to that. Chapter 1, verse 17. The first part of which reads, "And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." I prefer this latter explanation, that the book of Ecclesiastes is all Solomon's thoughts, but that sometimes he is stating the foolish or unrighteous viewpoint so that he can later counter it with truth and wisdom. Let's now consider the book. In chapter 1, verses 2 through 10, Solomon speaks of the rhythms and cycles of nature and how eternally constant the earth is with its rhythms and cycles. Ecclesiastes 1, 2 through 10. "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, See, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us." The sun rises and sets. The winds blow from one direction and then another and return. The waters of rivers flow into the sea continually, neither running dry nor overflowing the seas into which they empty their waters. Everything is the same as it was, and so shall it ever be, in endless repetition of cycles. Compared to all this order on a cosmic scale, man and his life and work are so insignificant that Solomon said in verse 3, "What profit, what lasting benefits and impact on the order of things is there in a man's work, even in his life's work? A man works all his life, and what is there to show for it?" This is the central question of the first three chapters of the book. The word vanity, which we've already encountered and appears many times in the book, is Strong's number 1892, and it has the thought of emptiness. Vanity is emptiness, or something unsatisfying, unrewarding, or also transitory, of short duration, not lasting, not permanent. This is the meaning of the word vanity, and we'll encounter it many times. In verse 13 and 14, Solomon speaks of mankind's labors as the punishment for Adam's sin. Ecclesiastes 1, 13 and 14. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised with. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Your margin may say, to afflict them, for the words, to be exercised with, in verse 13. This is a statement of that part of the curse upon Adam and the earth, when God said in Genesis 1:19, in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. This is a part of the permission of evil, which God put upon mankind. In verses 16 through 18, Solomon declares his purpose, to know and experience not only the good that is in life, the positive and normal contents of human knowledge, but also its counterpart, error and perversion in its various forms. This is what Solomon writes this book about, his quest for knowledge and experience, not only of wisdom and righteousness, which God had already given him, but of the vanity of mankind's labor under the Adamic curse, mankind's foolishness and unrighteousness. And here, in the beginning of the book, Solomon tells us what he gained from that search. Great sorrow, grief, and vexation of spirit. Let's read again verse 17, the entire verse. Ecclesiastes 1:17. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, we won't read them now, but in that account we see how Solomon builds great edifices and acquires all the comforts and trappings of richness. But in verse 11 of chapter 2 he says, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Why do you suppose Solomon felt that all these great gardens and pools and houses and servants and treasures that he acquired and built were vanity? It is because after he was gone, he would leave them all to another. And that heir to which he would leave all these things might turn out to be a fool. This bothered Solomon so much that he said in verses 17 through 20 of chapter 2, Ecclesiastes 2:17 through 20, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. Verse 24 gives us the good thought, the good and true lesson concerning a person's labor and how he should view it. Ecclesiastes 2:24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. That is, take pleasure today in the things you accomplish by your labor today, by the grace of God providing food and drink, means of sustenance. Don't seek after excessive gain, to hoard, only to leave it to others at death. Neither be dissatisfied or bitter if your daily gain is less than you desire. Enjoy the good of your labor, and be pleased. This same thought is repeated in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 12 and 22. Ecclesiastes 3:12, I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And verse 22, wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? The lessons for the consecrated are on several levels in these first three chapters. The most plain is that we are not to desire a life of ease, comfort, and self-gratification, wasting our time and energies laboring for the temporal things which are vanity, emptiness, transitory, and unsatisfying. An additional and higher lesson is in the seasons and cycles by which God guides the earth and by which he deals with mankind. We read of these in chapter 1, verses 2 through 10. The church recognizes this principle, this method of God's dealing with the consecrated, both as a class and as individuals. But rather than be vexed at what might be our feeling of inability to labor for God on our own schedule, according to our times and seasons, independent of and beyond his preordained seasons and cycles, we humbly submit to God's will and his plan in our search for the truth and in our quest for service. Only in this humility and cooperation and respect for God's methods and times and seasons are our labors joyful, blessed, and good, from the hand of God, as Solomon said in chapter 2, verses 24 through 26. Another scripture from the New Testament that conveys this same thought is John 4, 23 and 24. Let's turn to that and read it. John 4, 23 and 24. But keep your finger in Ecclesiastes because we'll be returning there. John 4, 23 and 24. But the hour cometh and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. A knowledge of the truth is essential before we can worship in spirit and in truth. Just as a spirit of worship without the truth is not sufficient or accepted, so likewise a knowledge of the truth is not sufficient or accepted without a spirit of worship. A man might be a heathen and have a great deal of the spirit of worship, but he could not render acceptable worship unless he had the truth. Or conversely, we might have much of the knowledge of the truth, but if we do not go to God in spirit, in the right attitude of heart, our worship would not be acceptable, no matter how much we know. One of Satan's long-used tools has been to polarize Christians at two extremes of an issue, while the correct place is somewhere in between. This particular issue, in this one of the spirit and the knowledge of the truth, at one extreme are some who are of such narrow vision in their defense of the truth that they smite their own brethren, bite and devour one another, and lose the spirit of the truth. On the other extreme are those so broad in their feeling after God that they absorb error into their thinking. The correct position, a balance of truth and its spirit, lies somewhere in between. The first eight verses of chapter 3 are poetic and reaffirm Solomon's thesis in chapter 1 that God rules the universe in seasons and cycles, which man is powerless to change, and that man does best when he conducts himself appropriately at each time in cooperation with those seasons and cycles. And we're going to read those verses and consider these in detail. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. There is an entire discourse in these 8 verses, but we'll give just a few brief thoughts. To everything there is a season. Every work or labor man can undertake has a right time or circumstances when that work is in accordance with God's plans and the cycles of nature, and when that work will be fruitful. Conversely, there are wrong times when that same work could be undertaken not in accordance with the cycles of natures, and that work would be out of harmony with God's rule and not blessed. The first examples, as we read, a time to be born and a time to die, are both beyond our control, but they mark the limits in time of those labors which are under our control. There is a springtime to plant or sow, and an autumn time to reap, to pluck up, to harvest. A time to kill. In justice, the law demanded a life for a life and death of blasphemers and the rebellious. And there is a time to heal, to punish but rehabilitate less serious offenders. A time to break down old walls, homes, and buildings beyond repair, and a time to build up newer, stronger structures. A time to weep and mourn and dance and laugh can be applied to many of life's circumstances. A time to cast away stones is appropriate when we think that stones are sometimes in the way and should be cast out, as from a vineyard or field. Texts you can look up are Isaiah 5:2, or from a roadway where stones should be cast out. See Isaiah 62:10. And sometimes stones can be profitably gathered together to build an altar. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing is taken by most commentators to refer to the physical love between a man and a woman. And these two times can be applied in two ways. One application being a recommendation of marriage and a warning against fornication and adultery. A companion text is Hebrews 12:4. And the other application of a time to embrace and refrain could refer to a man and his wife in the monthly cycles of their embracing and refraining. Verse 6 seems to apply to business pursuits, obtaining and keeping profitable assets while selling or otherwise getting rid of the unprofitable. In verse 7, a time to rend the clothes is in grief. Matthew 26:65 is one companion text. And a time to keep silence in mourning, as Job's 3 comforters did, is contrasted with a time to mend and speak good words to those who are in need of encouragement. And lastly, in verse 8, are described the extreme opposites of emotion between individuals, love and hate, and between peoples, war and peace. Those are just a few of the literal examples of what this poem speaks of. Many more examples could be given. But I think each of these pairs of opposites can also be applied to our spiritual growth and to its opposite, our battle with the flesh. Let's look again now at each one of these pairs. We'll go over these verses one more time, but this time looking for the spiritual lessons. A time to be born and a time to die marks beginnings and endings. In the Christian's life, the beginning of our spiritual life is at spirit begettal, which coincides with a time to die, the death of our old will. The second application of beginnings and endings to our spiritual life we can think of is when we are born of the Spirit, which coincides with another time to die, the death of our old body. A time to plant and a time to pluck up perhaps speaks of us as the wheat class, which is sown and harvested, and our faith. Like wheat, we are rooted and grounded in the truth, the planting of the Lord, as Isaiah said in chapter 61, verse 3 of his prophecy. And if we remain planted, that as our Master said in John 10:28-29, I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father which gave them me is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. But if one begotten of the Spirit lose the Spirit, becomes dead to spiritual things, willfully and intentionally returning to the old life of sin. Then there is a time to pluck up, as Jude said in verse 12 of his epistle. These are trees whose fruit withered, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. A time to kill and a time to heal reminds us of killing the old man, mortifying the deeds of the body, as Paul wrote in Romans 8:13. And a time to heal brings to mind the great physician and healer spoken of in Psalms 103, verse 1 through 3. Let's turn to that and read that. Psalms 103, verse 1 to 3. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgiveth all thine iniquities, who healeth all thy diseases. And also Psalm 147, verse 3, where it says, he healeth the broken of heart and bindeth up their wounds. A time to break down and a time to build up in these spiritual applications reminds us of walls around a city. And in 2 Corinthians 10:4, Paul said the weapons of our warfare are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. One of my favorite scriptures about the importance of building up good walls is Proverbs 25:28, which speaks of the importance of self-control. Proverbs 25:28. He that hath no rule over his spirit is like a city that is broken down, and without walls. A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance suggests that we take note of our brethren's spirit and enter into their joys and sorrows, as Paul wrote in Romans 12:15, rejoice with them that rejoice and weep with them that weep. Casting away stones is removing any stumbling block to our own or our brother's progress in the natural way, and gathering stones together, as Samuel did when he set a stone between Mizpah and Shem and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, hitherto the Lord hath helped us, gives us stones of remembrance of the Lord's providence in our lives, which we can gather together in the darker hours and take comfort from them. A time to embrace is almost always, but a time to refrain from embracing amongst our brethren could be applied to those rare instances when a brother is in need of reproof and correction, and we must not be fearful or hesitant to do so. The words, a time to get, remind me of Proverbs 4:7, get wisdom. With all thy getting, get understanding. The margin in your Bible for Ecclesiastes 3:6 might say the word seek is a better translation than the word get. And if so, that brings to mind admonitions to seek meekness, seek righteousness, and to seek first the kingdom of heaven. In verse 7 of Ecclesiastes 3, in these spiritual applications of these pairs of opposites, a time to rend could suggest many things. I think of severing earthly ties. And a time to sow makes me think of the embroidery of character development that each of us sews onto our robe of Christ's righteousness. A time to keep silence is more often than we practice, and a time to speak is not nearly as often as we think. And the final verse of the poem, Ecclesiastes 3:8, can be applied in so many ways. Here are a few. We are to love righteousness and hate iniquity, love the sinner but hate the sin, love the Lord our God and our neighbors. The time for war and the time for peace is both now and in the future. We war against the world and the flesh and the devil, against principalities and powers, yet great peace have they which love thy law. In the future, we will have peace from our personal struggle when we are on the other side of the veil and our warfare here is ended. But there will still remain even then our part of the battle against the institutions of this present evil world, which will be torn down by the Lamb of God and his saints before the kingdom is fully established. In the rest of chapter 3, Solomon again says how man's labor is vanity and vexation because it does not continue with him after his death. Indeed, in death, man even has no preeminence over the animals, the brute beasts, because they all have one breath. These verses are treated in detail in volume 5, the chapter on man, the subject of the atonement, where Pastor Russell explains the concepts of the body, spirit, soul, and the breath of life. Looking back now on the first three chapters of the book that we have considered, we see in chapters 1-3, Solomon speaking of the disappointment and vexation he felt, and all people feel, from the vanity of their labors. Looking now at the next three chapters, chapters 4, 5, and 6, they turn even darker in Solomon's thoughts as he considers the evil that men do in connection with their labors. While a common expression in the first three chapters, as we read, was, "And I saw vanity under the sun," in the second three chapters, chapters 4, 5, and 6, an oft-repeated phrase is, "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun." We'll read just a few verses to set the tone, and then focus on a particularly good lesson in the first part of chapter 5. But let's first read chapter 4, verses 1-3. Ecclesiastes 4, 1-3, where Solomon laments, "So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they which hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." It's not bad enough man's labor is vanity, transitory emptiness, unsatisfying. But to make it worse, men oppress each other, and the oppressed and the oppressors are still unhappy, having no comforter. And this oppression is particularly true, we see in our day, along one specific line that Solomon mentions in Ecclesiastes 5:13. Ecclesiastes 5:13. "There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt." Rich men heaping riches upon riches to keep them in greediness is what Solomon is speaking of here, and we see this so prevalently in our day. And Solomon says that it is a sore evil and an oppression, and truly the world is suffering as a result of it. In the first part of chapter 5 is the lesson we particularly want to consider. Let's read now verses 1-3. Ecclesiastes 5, 1-3. "Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words." "Keep thy foot" can have two meanings here. Watch where you stand, and watch where you walk. We stand on the foundation of truth, the solid rock where God has placed our feet, out from the miry clay we once were in. To watch where we walk is to watch our conduct in the house of God, our meeting places, not only here on Sunday, but throughout the week. And the emphasis on watching our conduct seems to be on our conversation. We should be ready to hear much and speak little. And when we do speak, it should be those things which are profitable to our brethren. Reverence and decorum are contained in this thought of keeping our feet when we enter into the house of God. And in this issue, as in many others, Satan again tries to polarize Christians into two camps of extreme thought for whom there is no common meeting ground, when all the time the true correct position lies somewhere in between. For centuries, the nominal Christian churches were sanctimonious and even foreboding in the affected holiness of their worship. The spirit of fear that this created stifled the spirit of worship into mere formalism. In the past few centuries, Christians have rejected that stilted form of worship for the true form of worship, But some have gone too far in the other direction, to the extreme of disorder and lack of reverence in their worship. The truth lies somewhere in between, and we should strive to attain it, remembering as our guideline for finding this correct position the words of Solomon in verse 2, "For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth." That is, God looks down and observes his children always, but especially when we come together to worship him. In verses 4 through 6 of Ecclesiastes 5, Solomon presents another bit of counsel from his wisdom. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 6. "When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands?" These verses are often used to guide us in not making additional vows to God beyond our consecration vow. Not that all such additional vows are ill-advised. Some are made and kept to good spiritual advantage. But a vow that cannot be or is not kept is hated by God, because God, in his own nature, keeps his own word. His word returns not to him void. And we, if we would be godlike, must keep our vows. Our consecration vow, above all, must be kept. We cannot take God's covenant into our mouths and then say it was an error on our part, either because we did not understand fully, or on God's part because it was not accepted. Our vow of consecration will avail us little or nothing if we prove unfaithful to it and reject it, except that that vow will rise up in judgment against us. We're going to skip quickly over chapters 7 through 11, so that we can come to Solomon's final lesson in chapter 12 and also his conclusion. I'll read just a few texts from these chapters, 7 through 11, which are much like the Proverbs of Solomon, which he also wrote. Some of these almost have a spirit of humor to them. To those who say, "Remember the good old days," Solomon replies in Ecclesiastes 7:10, "Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this." To those who have found a good marriage partner, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 9:9, "Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun." In Ecclesiastes 9:11 we read, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong." A famous saying we often hear, that the humorous writer Damon Runyon added the coda, "But that's the way to bet." In Ecclesiastes 10:1, we have the words from which the modern expression, "a fly in the ointment," evolved. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. "So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor." The lesson, of course, is that an honorable reputation earned by a lifetime of good works is ruined by a single folly. In Ecclesiastes 11:1, Solomon counsels generosity without expectation of return, but yet that return is often forthcoming. Ecclesiastes 11:1, "Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days." The words "cast thy bread upon the waters" have the thought of spreading or sowing, not discarding. A symbolic application to us could be that we who have the bread of life, the truth, should sow that truth generously upon the waters to peoples. The final chapter of Ecclesiastes opens with an interesting allegory. Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 7. "Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. while the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. In the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those that look out of the windows be darkened. And the door shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Also when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fears shall be in the way, and the almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail. Because man goeth to his long home, and the mourners go about the streets. Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. The admonition of verse 1 is memorized by children at an early age, and the warning is that when you are old and tired and feeble, you will be less able and less fit bodily, physically, to render the service you desire. Similar expressions are from Jeremiah in Lamentations 3:27. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. And from our Lord himself to Peter, as he slept in the Garden of Gethsemane, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Verses 2 through 7 of Ecclesiastes 12 are a detailed allegory of the aging process. Let's consider each of the elements of this allegory verse by verse. The sun, moon, and light being dimmed refers to the loss of eyesight, common in the elderly. And clouds could refer to loss of memory, a clouded mind or memory. Or the clouds could refer to trouble or distress of any kind that comes upon those who are aged. In verse 3, the keepers of the house are the hands and the arms that tremble and shake with infirmity. The strong men are the legs, which grow weak and bow themselves, no longer able to support the body. The grinders, which become few, are the teeth, which decay and fall out or are extracted. Those that look out of the windows being darkened is an apt symbol of eye disease, culminating in blindness. In verse 4, the doors shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low seems to signify that at the end of their working life, when their work of life is done, the aged are isolated, shut in, away from the younger and the middle-aged. Rising at the voice of the bird means getting up early, because sleep escapes them. The daughters of music brought low refers to a loss of hearing, which usually begins with a diminishing of the higher-pitched tones, gradually resulting in a lowering of the intensity or volume of what can be heard. In verse 5, being afraid of that which is high suggests the fear of falling down stairs, either ascending or descending stairs. A fear in the way is a general fear of danger outside the safety and the security of home. The almond tree, the literal almond tree, has white flowers, and its flourishing signifies the whitening or the graying of the hair. The grasshopper, a small insect, becoming a burden may signify how, in advanced age, the little things become exaggerated and troublesome burdens. And desire shall fail, a loss of appetite for food. The long home is the grave, and the mourners go about in the streets at the time of the funeral. Verse 6 adds a few more physical troubles associated with advanced age. The silver cord being loosed could describe the loss of hair as men grow bald. Or perhaps the silver cord represents the spinal cord of our bodies, the nervous system, which sometimes fails in old age, leading to paralysis and infirmity. The golden bowl may refer to the brain and its decline in a stroke, or perhaps to the reproductive organs, the seat of man's God-given, almost divine powers of procreation, which become useless in the elderly. The pitcher broken at the fountain may signify the lungs, with coughing and shortness of breath, unable to draw the life-sustaining air into the body. And the wheel broken at the cistern is like a defective pump, the heart, stricken by disease or attack. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. You'll recall when we considered chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, all those, a time for this and a time for that, we drew two sets of lessons from them. And we could do the same here in chapter 12. We have just considered the lessons in this allegory referring to the decline of the physical body. But in addition, in these elements of this allegory, there is also a picture of the potential decline of our spiritual vitality. And we are warned to be on guard against that decline. I'll mention just one, our time is growing short, and leave the rest for you to find applications. In verse 2, drawing now spiritual applications of this allegory, the darkening of the sun, light, moon, and stars could signify a loss of appreciation for four things: the gospel truth, the sun, the love of righteousness, the light, Old Testament types, the moon, and appreciation of our fellow saints, particularly those who have gone before us, the stars. Clouds returning after the rain might suggest that in such a condition, some find the rain, their study of the waters of truth and fellowship with the brethren, which should normally be a blessing and a refreshment, as literal rain is to the farmer, are instead followed by clouds, troubling feelings reminding them of their loss of appreciation and commitment to sacrifice. There are many more lessons in this allegory, each of the elements verse by verse that we could discuss, but we need to pass on now to Solomon's own concluding thoughts. Chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. Ecclesiastes 12, 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Two admonitions. Fear God and keep His commandments. Had Father Adam done so, mankind would not have its labor of vanity under the sun, the permission of evil, to be exercised with. The lesson for the consecrated as well is to reverence God in our individual lives when we are among the world apart from one another, and when we come together in the house of God to worship Him in spirit and in truth. And keep His commandments. By his experience of a wasted life, Solomon concluded this to be the proper course. The world of mankind will reach a similar conclusion in the future after their experience with sin and, by contrast, the kingdom of righteousness. We now have commandments to keep, as our Lord declared in John 13:34, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another." Looking back on his life, Solomon regretted his course and gave his counsel to those who would hear and be benefited by it. Perhaps he would have closed this teaching with the salutation, "Regretfully yours." I'd like to close this discourse with the salutation, "Encouragingly yours." And may the Lord add his blessing.